All right, welcome everybody to chapter 10 of our course on functional programming. Remember that last week and chapter 9 we talked about the I/O monad. What I want to do today is to summarize or go over that really quickly to show you where you can find more information about that. I hope you played a little bit, that you tried to do the exercises, that you written a few programs, simple programs, using the I/O monad. If you want to learn more about monads, there's plenty of papers abound on the web. I can recommend Phil Wotler's papers. If you go to Phil Wotler's homepage, he has a number of papers written on monads. Very highly recommended. What I'm showing you here is the webpage of the standard Haskell Prelude for that shows the monad class, that shows the operators in the monad class. You see here the first one, that's the bind that I used last week. The next one is a variation of bind called then that doesn't use the parameter. That is used when in the previous examples where we were using an I/O computation but didn't pull out the value. That's the one that you can use for that, so you don't have to write a lambda expression. And if we're going down here, you see a number of derived operations on monads that amplify what I called last time is the fact that I can kind of glue together side effect in computation. So for example, this sequence guy here, the first one, takes a list of monadic operations and returns a list of results inside the monad. Another thing that I want to point out briefly is that if you look at the signatures of this guy, this monad class here, this monad class M and the definition here, what it does is it abstracts over the type constructor. So this is a class where M varies not over a type variable, but over a type constructor. You can see that here, because M is used here as a type constructor. So this M can be parser, or it can be I/O. And this kind of higher kind of polymorphism, where you're defining a polymorphic type that doesn't take a type parameter, but takes a function from types to types, or even a function from types to types to types, whatever higher kindness, that is something that is very, very unique to Haskell. And to tie it back to Link and C#, the CLR generics don't allow higher kinded types, and that's why in C# we had to define Link as a pattern, because we cannot formalize something like this in C#, where we say, you know, something is a monad if it has these operations. There's no way in the C# or the CLR type system to express that notion, and that's why we have to rely on a pattern based, where the compiler says, well, you do it, if it works out, it works out. But there's no way to kind of declare that this is an instance of my standard sequence operators. Okay, that was enough from last week. Let's go to this week's lecture. And this week's lecture is where we go a little bit drilled down, a little bit deeper into types and classes that we did also in chapter 3. How do you declare a new type in Haskell? Well, just like you declare a new function, I can give a name to an existing type using a type declaration. In this case, you write type string equals list of character. This is a type declaration that is in the standard prelude. We kept talking about, oh, strings are just list of characters. Well, that is because string is defined as an alias for list of characters, or a synonym. And here's another example. I can define a point or a position as a pair of two integers. And now I can define a new position, saying the origin, 0, 0, which is a type, a value of type position. And I can define an operation that takes a point and moves it to the left, How does it do that? Well, it takes the x-coordinate and subtracts 1 from that. And here you see that a type synonym doesn't really introduce a new type. It's just an alias, a synonym for the existing type. So when I do left and define left, I just pattern match on the pair x, y. Why can I do that? Well, because position was just defined as a pair of integers. So there's no new abstraction. I'm not hiding the type. I'm just giving a shorter name to that type. And in a very deep sense, a type synonym, you can see that as a function on types. And here's the example where we actually do that. We give a parameter to this type declaration, so we can define the type of pairs of type of, but elements of type A using the following type declaration: pair of A equals pair of A comma A. And now we can apply that type function to a type argument. For example, pair int. Pair int, if I unfold that, well, pair of A was defined as A comma A, so this is exactly the same as int comma int. Just when I would define a function, pair of A equals A comma A, and then I can apply that function to 13, and that would give me the pair 13, 13. So this is on the value level, and this is on the type level. And for symmetry, I should put that declaration here. I say type pair of A equals A comma A. And again, let me emphasize that in Haskell, it's no coincidence that the syntax for types and the syntax for terms looks very similar. And also the fact that here I'm defining a function on types and I can define a function on values. And everything looks very similar. Now there are other functional languages that with things called dependent types, where you really merge the difference between the type world and the value world. There's one language that people in Graham Hutton's group, who wrote the book, I hope that you all have the book, worked on. That's called, if I pronounce that right, ACDA. And then there's another very interesting language, which is called Cayenne, from Hot Peppers. I think you spell it like that. Which is also, these are two variations, Haskell-like languages, that mix the worlds of types and values. And if you're interested in the foundations of functional programming, there you can go on for years and years. There's things like Coq, that's like a French variation of OCaml or in that family, that also mixes types and values. So there's a lot of interesting things here when you merge these worlds. But in Haskell, they are very separated, which means that I cannot use a value in an expression concerning types, and I cannot put a type in an expression that concerns values. So the worlds are very similar, they're very parallel, but there's a strict separation, there's a strict layering. And you get very interesting languages when you allow different ways where these two worlds depend on each other. And the ultimate work on that is Hank Barndrecht's so-called Lambda Cube, that explores all the possibilities. And if you visualize all the ways that types and terms can depend on each other, you get a cube, and that's why it's called the Lambda Cube. If you have some spare time, I definitely can recommend that branch of functional programming. very much foundational. And my feeling is that if we look back to Haskell in, say, 5 to 10 years, I bet you Haskell will have evolved into a fully dependently typed language where types and terms can be freely intermixed. All right. So let's finish this example. I was digressing a little bit. So we have defined type pair here. And now I can define a function multiplication that takes a pair of integers and returns an integer that just better matches on this pair and multiplies the two. Again, because pair doesn't introduce a new type, it's just an alias, I can do that pattern matching. Or I can create a pair by duplicating the value, and that is this function copy. Take something of type A to pair of A, and it just returns a tuple, a pair with two copies of X. This bottom one, again, is a function, if you look at the type, if I look at that type that copy has, a arrow a comma a, the type dictates what that function should be. There's only one reasonable implementation of this, namely that takes this guy and copies it. The other ones are that I take this guy, throw it away, and put here a non-terminating expression, bottom, or I take this guy and put non-termination here and that guy there. But those are kind of all cheating. The only real way is to take this guy and duplicate it. And people, again, Leonard Augustin, who wrote Cayenne, has written also a very nifty program, I think it's called Gin, that will take a type and will give you the term that has that type. It's very nice for doing your homework. If I say, you know, you have to write a function of this type, you just let the computer synthesize that program for you, because in many cases, if you have a suitably polymorphic type, there's only one obvious implementation for that. Another thing I want to remind you of, I mentioned this before, Phil Wotler's paper on theorems for free. If you haven't read it yet, I hope that by now you are feeling more confident in your functional programming skills. So try to read that paper again or download it now for the first time. A very, very good paper. I read that paper every Christmas time. I reread that to refresh my mind. That's one of the most beautiful papers that I know in the functional programming world. Okay. Let's give a couple of more examples of type synonyms. Type synonyms can build on top of each other, so they can be nested. I can define my type of point, position, int, pair of ints. Now I can define a transformation, which is a function from position to position. This is perfectly fine. I can use type synonyms to define other type synonyms. However, I cannot define recursive type synonyms. So for example, if I try to define tree to be a pair of int and a list of trees, that is forbidden. And the reason is that these type synonyms are just, as I said, they're synonyms. So I should be able to unfold their definition. So if I look at this guy here, that would mean it's like an infinite type, because if I unfold tree on the right-hand side, it says, you know, tree is int, a pair of int, and a list of pairs of ints and trees. And so I can, you know, keep unfolding that. So instead, when you have a recursive type, you have to break every cycle with another kind of type declaration, namely an algebraic data type. And what is an algebraic data type? Well, an algebraic data type is a type declaration that introduces a new type. It's not a type synonym. It introduces a completely new type that itself can be defined in terms of other types. But you have to explicitly construct that type, and you have to explicitly deconstruct the type. And in that way, if you have a recursive cycle, there's now this kind of, you know, boundary that cuts the recursive cycle with one of those algebraic data types that you have to explicitly construct and destruct. Let's look at the most simple, well, this is not really the most simple one. That would probably unit, but this is a very simple type. That's a bool, which is a type that has two values, false and true. And so when we write this in Haskell, data bool, this means I'm defining a new type, and that type then here on the right-hand side, you have a number of alternatives of what that type can be. And in this case, there's only two, so there's false and true. Now, how does this translate to the way we define types in an object-oriented way? And in chapter 3, I mentioned this. I'll mention this again. In C-sharp, or in an object-oriented language, what you would do is you would define an abstract base class, abstract class bool, and then I define two concrete types, class true inherits from bool, and class false inherits from bool. And now I have to put all the noise that comes with class declarations. And these are really sealed, because you cannot inherit from these guys, because these guys are, you cannot have, like, you know, define false as another union of type. So that's why it's sealed here. So this is what an algebraic data type corresponds more or less. I'm defining an abstract base class for the left-hand side, and these are two subtypes of that type. So in this case, bool is a type that has two concrete subclasses, false and true, and then this implicitly defines also the constructors. So when I use the constant false, that is a constructor call to the type true, which has type bool. And in Haskell, this type true really doesn't exist. You're really constructing something of the common supertype. On the other hand, as we will see, you can do pattern matching. So you can do try to downcast to this type. But in function declarations, I can only write a function f that takes a bool to something. I cannot say f takes true do something, which in some it makes sense that you could do this, because if I only calling f with true, then the type of f should reflect the fact that I'm not pattern matching on false. But Haskell kind of cheats, or is like imprecise. You just define your function on the common supertype, and then I can do a pattern match here on true and false, which in an object-oriented language would be that I try to downcast the argument to true or false, and in that case do something. So pattern matching is really downcasting, and algebraic data types is really a very stylized form of class declarations. So true and false are called the constructors of type bool. As we have seen in chapter 3, types and constructor names always should begin with an uppercase letter. That's how the compiler or the language can distinguish between identifiers and type identifiers, value identifiers and type identifiers. And these context, these data declarations, another way to look at them are as context-free grammars, or BNF, where this is the left-hand side of your grammar, and this is a right-hand side, which is a list of alternatives. That's another way of looking at it. Or, as we will see later, these data declarations correspond to abstract syntax trees. I think that's a slightly better analogy. That's really what they are. You define an abstract syntax tree. So here's another type. Answers, which is yes, no, or unknown. This is a type with three values. And now I can define things like answers, which gives me a list of answers. And it returns the it's defined as the list yes, no, unknown. And I can model a politician here that flip-flops between various answers. So if he said yes before, it now flips to no. If he says no before, it flips to yes. And if he was undecided, it's still undecided. So this is a function now where I pattern match over each of these alternatives of the answer type. The function type is still answer to answer. Okay, so the type of the function is the super type of all these things. And each clause here you can understand as trying to do a subtype. What is the dynamic type of that argument? If it's yes, then I do this. If it's no, I do this. And then the result type is again upcast to answer. So flip, if I would leave out the second and the third clause, would not have type yes to no. It still has type answer to answer. Let's look at a more interesting algebraic type that has values inside it. A class shape that is a circle with a float of the diameter, I guess, and a rectangle with the width and the height. This is what you often would do in a object-oriented language, right? Shapes. That's the typical example. And there you would define, again, an abstract base class shape with two subtypes for circle and rectangle. And I can now define a square here, which is a rectangle where the sides are the same. And I don't define a new type for that. I just define a function that returns a shape. And that's a trick you can do in object-oriented program too. You don't have to define a new square class. You just define a special constructor for rectangle that returns a rectangle where the sides are the same. Now, in an object-oriented language, this function area would be defined as an instance method on shape. And then circle and rectangle would override that definition. So it would be a virtual function defined in shape that you override inside circle and rectangle. Very similar here in Haskell, except that you now define this area function by pattern matching over the constructors. So I define area as a function from shape to float. Read that as it's a virtual method defined on the shape class, and it returns a float. And if I have a circle, I override the area method to mean pi times r squared. And if I have a rectangle, I override it with x times y. But the way you order your the definitions is instead of putting them inside the shape class and then overriding it wherever you want to, you now define them all at once in this single function that does a pattern match over it. And people in the forums already pointed at this thing called the expression problem. That's an interesting problem that, in this case, in Haskell, it's easy to define a new function. So, for example, if I want to have a function that computes the parameter of a shape, I can just define that outside. I don't have to change the shape declaration. I don't have to go and edit the data shape declaration there. That could be in a library that I don't own, but I can just define a new function that takes a shape and add a new function to that. So it's easy to extend shape with new virtual methods, so to speak. I don't have to edit the definition of shape. What is much harder, however, is to add a new subtype to a shape. Suppose that I do want to have a type, say, rectangle or polygon. That is now very hard in Haskell, because now I have to go back to the shape type that I don't own and add a new alternative. Let me write that here. So if I say here data shape, and this, now I would have to say polygon with something. Well, I cannot really do that, because that data type shape is not under my control. That's defined in some library that's already, you know, compiled and so on. So in Haskell, it's really, really hard to add a new subtype to a given type, but it's really easy to add a new virtual method to a given type. And the reason that that's why I used a sealed here in this example, this data type is really sealed, so there's no way I can add new subtypes. On the other hand, in an object-oriented language, it's really easy, if it's not sealed, to add a new subtype. I can easily define polygon as a new subtype of shapes, and then I can override the area method. But it's much harder to add a new virtual method to the shape class, because now I have to go to all other subtypes and add that virtual method there. So it's like pick your poison. You can either extend in one dimension, or you can extend in another dimension. Now, the quest to find a way to have your cake and eat it too, to be able to have extensibility in both dimensions, that's an open research problem, and there's a lot of papers published about that. And so if you search for the expression problem, you'll find a lot of papers that deal with that. All right. So, what are these constructors? Well, just like in an object-oriented language, when you define a class, you get a constructor that has the same name as the class, where you say new circle. In Haskell, it's the same, only you don't write new, but it's a special function that starts with an uppercase, whereas all the other Haskell functions start with a lowercase. So you can also, in Haskell, you can see when you call a constructor, because you see circle with a capital letter, which is very similar to in C# or VB or Java when you write new. And if you ask Hux or GHCI to tell you the type of circle of the constructor, it will tell you it's a function that takes a float and returns a shape. And if you say a rectangle, it's a function that takes a float and a float and returns a shape. So really, that's very, very similar, completely isomorphic to a constructor that you get in an object-oriented language. So I really like to emphasize the correspondences between these things. A lot of people think, oh, functional programming and object-oriented programming, they are completely different worlds. Really, they're not that different. Functional programming and object-oriented programming are very close. And that is very helpful if you look at the correspondences instead of the differences, because then you can steal techniques from one world and use them in another, and vice versa. And that's always good, to have more tools in your toolbox as a programmer. So instead of sticking in the functional programming ghetto or in the object-oriented village, try to kind of unify, try to broaden your knowledge and use techniques from one to the other and vice versa. All right. This should come as no surprise that just like type decorations can have parameters, also data decorations can have parameters. In this case, we're defining the type maybe. It's a very common type in Haskell. Maybe that's either nothing or just A. This is a type that's used to deal with, it's very similar to nullable in C#. So where you want to say, well, there might be an A or there might be nothing, but you want to make that explicit. And there was an exercise in one of the earlier lectures to define a safe version of the function head, which took a list and takes the first element. Well, what happens if the element, if the list has no elements? Well, in that case, if you just return a value of type A, the only thing you can do is create an error, return bottom, return undefined. But in this case, we can define a safe head which takes a list of A and returns a maybe of A, where the safe head of empty is nothing and the safe head of axis is just the head, the normal head of axis. So it takes the first element of axis. And again, because of pattern matching, because patterns are matched top to bottom, we know that in this case axis is a non-empty list because the empty list was already matched by axis. Now I would say this definition of safe head is pretty useless, because you're still not, you still don't have a value of type A. You go from list to type maybe of A, which is really the same as a type of list with a single value. So let's look at that type. Maybe of A is nothing or just A. And we discussed this before. This really is like the empty list, and this is really like the singleton list. So in some sense, this safe head thing just pushes the problem a little bit further, because it goes from a list, an arbitrary list, to a list that's either empty or has a single element. So I'm not a big fan of using maybe. I rather stay with lists and don't bother with this kind of thing where I now know, yes, that it's either a singleton list or an empty list. I don't care. Just give me a list and then I can use all the operators on lists. But what is interesting is list is a monad, but also maybe is a monad. So that might be a nice exercise to try to write down the monad operators that I showed in the beginning of this lecture and define all of them for this maybe type. Okay, so even though I think, you know, you should never use this maybe type, it's a nice exercise to get familiar with monads, because this is a very, very simple simple monad. Now, we mentioned that type synonyms couldn't be recursive, but these data decorations can be recursive. And again, why is that? Because you have to explicitly construct them and you have to explicitly destruct them by doing pattern matching, or you construct them using these constructors. And hence, there is this recursive cycle that is broken. Here is a very simple recursive type that represents numbers, piano numbers. So a number is either zero or it's the successor of a number. So what are the values of this thing? Well, obviously zero. And then I can take a number and take the successor. So the values are zero, suc of zero, which is one, suc of zero, etc. And then, of course, there's always the bottom value. And in this case, since Haskell is lazy, there's also the infinite value, which is defined as follows. So let's look at the values. There's bottom. There's zero. There's suc composed n times. Let me write it like this. Applied to zero. So this is like a special case of that. But then there's also something where you take the infinite number, which you would define as something infinite is the suc of inf. And this is a perfectly well-defined value, because this guy takes you see that in the type there, it takes a number to a number. Well, then this type is number, so inf has type not. And then you see the types work out, because it takes a not here, so this not to not is not, so everything works out. And this thing is no problem in Haskell, because of laziness, it will not blow up. it will just calculate enough to go how far you want. Okay, so a value of type not is either 0 or suck of n, where n is a number. And here are the values that I just talked to you about. So you can just keep repeating, adding this constructor, but you can even add it an infinite number of times, or you can just say it's the undefined number. Okay, as we say, these numbers are natural numbers, and how do we see that? Well, just look at this example here. 0 corresponds to 0, and suck corresponds to plus 1. So the if I take the successor of 0 3 times, I expect to get 3. Well, we can formalize that, so we can define two functions. One, to take a number defined as this recursive type, and I can map that to an integer. And here you see that we're following the same recursive pattern that we did with lists. And now some alarm bells should go off in your head. Yes, you can define a fold for this type too. In fact, you can define a fold for any algebraic data type in Haskell. And there, again, there's papers, that's a topic called polytypic programming, where people write programs that kind of generate those folds automatically for you. And in this case, let's just stick now for now with recursion. So the if I want to convert one of those natural numbers to an integer, well, if I get a 0, it's 0. And otherwise, what do? I recursively turn that n into a natural number and then add 1 to it. And we can go the opposite. If you give me a 0, I map that to 0. And if I give you n plus 1, we used n plus k patterns there, then I recursively turn that integer into a natural number and then take the successor of that. An interesting exercise is to prove that these things are isomorphic. And here is how we can define addition over these natural numbers. We just convert them to integers, add them up, and then turn them to back to a natural number. But that's kind of inefficient, right? I'm first going through these numbers, adding them up as integers, and then turning them back into natural numbers. Well, we can do much better because we can define that directly. So we can define if I add 0 to a number, that's n. And if I add suck of m to another number, that's the suck of add of m and n. Now, if you look closely at this thing, you might remember that this looks scarily close to concatenating two lists. And if you look at this natural numbers type, it's scarily close to lists, where 0 corresponds to the empty list and suck corresponds to cons. And that is actually correct. And that's why this definition here works like this. So we can define, we can follow this type here, this expression here, and do the usual thing where we turn everything into this. All right. Now let's look at our last example for today. Arithmetic expressions. Arithmetic expressions are expressions built using plus and times and so on. We've seen these arithmetic expressions when we did our parsers. Let's define arithmetic expression. Again, it's a recursive type. An expression is either an integer, or it's an addition of two expressions, or it's a multiplication of two expressions. And here, down here, you see a expression form using constructors of 2 times 3 plus 1, or 1 plus 2 times 3, I should say, to be precise. Now we can define, using recursion, several functions that execute expressions. For example, I can define a function size that calculates the size of an expression, which is to say how many nodes are there in that expression. So if I have a value, that's 1, and otherwise I just kind of add the sizes of the addition and the multiplication of the children. So this doesn't compute the number of nodes, as I said before. It computes the number of values. A more interesting one is this function eval, which takes an expression and evaluates it as a number. And what it does is it replaces addition by addition, the add constructor by the plus operator, and it replaces the mul constructor by the multiplication operator. And again, that looks, now we have seen these two recursive functions here, and alarm bells should go off in your head and say, hey, I don't want to write this explicit using recursion. I want to write that recursion once, define a fault function for this type, and then I can phrase these two functions very, very succinctly by just saying, what is it val? What is the thing that I substitute add for? What is the thing I substitute multiplication for? And guess what? I can define a function fault and just write this. The val constructor becomes identity, add becomes plus, and multiplication becomes times. All right, the last example is a binary tree. It's a simple variation of this arithmetic tree, slightly simpler because there's only two constructors. There's a leaf, or there's a node with two subtrees and an integer at that leaf. Here you see a little example which has, you know, a couple of leaves and then some values in there. Now, if I want to search for a value, I can write the following recursive function. If it's if I'm at a leaf, I check if that's the value the same. If I'm at a node, I check if the value at the node is the same. Or I'm looking in the left subtree, or I'm looking in the right subtree. And again, since this or is lazy, just like in object-oriented languages, if you find it in the node, you're not going to recurse in the subtrees. If it's found in the left one, you're not going to go in the right one. But in the worst case, you do traverse the whole tree to find that value. Let's see how we can do better. Well, let's define the following function that takes a tree and flattens that tree into a list. Simple recursive function. I could define that as a fault as well. Now, if the flattening of this tree is an ordered list, then I know that this is like a search tree, or that this tree is ordered. So now when I'm looking at the value, I don't have to go both left and right, because I know that everything to the left is smaller than things on the right. So in this case, I can make this thing more efficient, where I'm using here this pattern guards. If it's at the leaf, I'm done. If it's in the node and the value is there, I'm done. And otherwise, I just check if the value I'm looking for is smaller than the value at the node. And then I just descend in the left one. And otherwise, I descend in the right one. So here we're using this property that when I flatten that thing, I could find it. Another way, what you could do is you could just use flatten and then run through that list. That would be exactly the same as this occurs because of laziness. All right, end of this lecture. As I said, if you look at these exercises, before you do that, I would recommend to you to define the fault functions and try to do these exercises instead of using recursion, or do them using recursion first and then define them using faults. Okay, so that was chapter 11. I think you should by now have a good grasp of Haskell and functional programming. And I hope that you also see the connections between functional programming and object-oriented programming, and that they're really not that different. Very, very similar. You're trying to solve exactly the same problems, and there are slight variations. But in the grand scheme of things, object-oriented programming and functional programming are really, really very close. So thank you, and see you next time for chapter 11.